Tonight, we are going to begin our work on 2157. Our first witness is the Attorney General.
We finally have a house bill we can look at.
Yeah, got a house bill finally. Lee, do you have possible conflict listed anyways?
Possible conflict? Well, I don't think we have that, Mr. Chairman. Watch out for them, try and pick them up.
Well, our research staff has 19.
Your Honor.
Possible conflicts of pending legislation.
Is it all pending?
The status has been shifting since I'm not sure how we progress the rest of the
Well, we picked up a couple of bills that have passed one out to the other. I think the conflict has reached something. Start to watch for it, so it's not a session here.
You seem awfully far away. Is it on my glasses getting weaker?
It's just your long table.
No, we used to be chummier, I know. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I met with Senator Ripper last week, and we agreed that in order to try to expedite action on this bill, and he sent a letter to all the agencies, as did I, and the question I want to say that we had also done this several months ago, but we got more responses this last round, to try to get all the agencies, if they had objections, to send their objections to us, to see if we couldn't work out any difference of opinion made just between my office and the agencies themselves, at least present you with some united point of view or where we actually have differences. And that is in part what I'm here for tonight is to present those. We have prepared some 13 amendments, which I think raise most of the policy issues that are involved in 2157 as that bill stands at this moment. The first off is amendment number one. It's very simple.
Do you have extra copies of those?
I should give you one. It's an outline, Chairman. The amendments are attached and they are numbered.
Does everybody have them? I'm sorry.
Chairman, I promise not to try to go into long sessions. I would be glad to answer any questions, but I realize you're under pressure time. I realize you've heard a lot of hearings. I've had a lot of hearings in the last 2 days. Amendment number one simply deletes section 12, which was the public records portion of 2157, which is now, of course, in Senate Bill 15. Now, amendment numbers 2 through 10, and also amendment 13, and pardon us for this kind of result that occurred because of the number system we were using. These are amendments that are presented by the various agencies. They wrote us letters, and in certain sections they thought we'd overlooked and so forth. And these are amendments that we have worked out with them, the agencies, and my office are in agreement on those amendments. They are supported both by my office and the agencies involved. I think most of them are, I would say all of them, are of a non-controversial nature. I'd be glad to go through those if the committee desires. They are summarized from the summary that you have there, and then actually the amendments are attached to the sheet that you have. I'll leave it to your pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
I think we can let those overlay in there.
Amendment number 11.
Where are they attached to our sheet, though?
Yes, they are, Mr. Chairman. There is first a summary. You have a two-page list of possible decisions that occurred to us that you may wish to make. And then you have a list of those amendments and a general summary of what those amendments, what department they came from, and what we have tried to reach. And I might mention, Mr. Chairman, there are two other agencies that submitted proposals, which we have not put in the amendments for. One was the personnel division. We wanted to restore two sections from Chapter 192, but I talked to Mr. Hughes this afternoon. He said on the basis of our opinion, those sections would be pure surplusage, and he agreed that they did not need those sections. The other was from the Department of Geology. They were concerned about the sections that repeal the present sections, given confidentiality to certain reports that were reported to the Department of Geology. We do have no reason for it because under Section 11, trade secrets are exempted from the law, and we think, in fact, the exemption in the proposed bill is actually broader than what they have now. The one they have now is limited as time, where ours is limited as subject. Amendment number 11, Mr. Chairman, I understand Mr. Gill will be here, is an amendment which was drafted by my office. It regards the state act of insurance funds. And Mr. Chairman, I just don't think it's appropriate for me to take a position as to whether the type of records FAIF is attempting to remain confidential. It's a decision which I think ought to be made by the legislature. It is not one I'm really in a position to recommend.
What's the current status of it, Lee?
It would be my opinion that under present law, they probably are not confidential. I think there are very strong reasons why they should be confidential. It really boils down to the question that the State Industrial Action Fund is in a unique position in the government. It is a government agency. It enjoys many of the attributes of the government agency, but it is also very much a competitor in the free enterprise world. And so I would prefer to let Mr. Gill give his reason for that and let you decide if we have. The Gill Department and our agency would agree as far as the form of language if you think that their records are entitled to exemption. Under paragraph 4, I think then brings up basically paragraph 1, 2, and 3 of the memo I give you deal with the question of exemption. Paragraph 4 deals with the question of the procedure. You will recall under section 6 of 2157, we had provided for administrative review by the Office of Attorney General and also in regard to local matters by the Office of the District Attorney. Now, I think there may be some real question in your mind as to whether there should be this administrative review. As I stated earlier, it's our position that we think it is a good thing to have. It's a good thing to try. Because one of the big problems that has arisen in every other state and has arisen in the federal government is the problem of what does the ordinary citizen do when he's been refused disclosure of certain documents by a government agency? It's his only choice to go into court. Going to court, even at the initial stages, is an expensive process. This was designed to provide a very speedy administrative review, but you may decide that you not want that procedure. If you do decide that you want that procedure, you may decide that it should go in some other office other than the Office of the Attorney General. We certainly don't have any hang-up about this. In fact, it's a task we're not really sure we want. We just have to feel that probably the only office that's in a position to accept that responsibility. We have drawn amendments. If you want to make it eliminate the concept of this administrative review and make it a direct judicial review, we have drawn amendments to that to carry out that purpose. Also, I'd like to mention under the administrative review provision, we had a provision that said that even though there was administrative review, if the records were not under the control of another elected official, then they would not be subject to that and there would be direct judicial review. You may want to eliminate that provision.
Did you consider legislative counsel?
That's a possibility. That is sort of I thought about that one this afternoon. That's your spot on that.
Well, if you don't think it's really right for your agency to do it, that would be the only alternative for your agency to do it.
Frankly, we're going to have to do it anyway. You know, they're going to ask us, can they withhold this? And we're going to probably say no. But that is possible. I think the one point you make, Chairman, is that probably should be an officer who is judicially trained. I suggest very strongly, Mr. Chairman, that you do review the exemptions listed in Section 11. You try to cover those as best we can. They are a matter of decision on your part. I repeat, Section 13 deletes the concept of the executive privilege. Our office does not feel this is appropriate in Oregon law. As far as I know, the governor's office is not taking a position on this. The remaining sections, which make up the great bulk of this bill, are really technical amendments to conform to the first section, the first 11 sections. I'm here to answer your question.
I think maybe we better go through the Plunger ruling out, please.
Fine.
And I want the committee to open, holler, yell, and scream if you have any problems. So wait for me.
Okay, amendment number, it says amendment number one merely strikes out Section 12, which dealt with open meetings, and that's now covered by Senator Hurst's bill, Bill 15. The second amendment, amendment number two, came as a result of suggestions by the Revenue Department. First off, it was to add a section that in our compilation we missed. Our confidential tax records, and secondly, to make it very clear, the confidentiality of those tax records remains, even though they may be disclosed to another public office, because the governor has access to them, my office under certain circumstances has access to them, and likewise, also the Welfare Recovery Division, to merely keep that confidentiality, even though it is left the Department of Revenue. The amendment number three relates to the bank fund.
It's been a couple of months since we've been through this bill, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if we could go through it again. Attorney General,
okay.
And point out the changes of the amendments
right. I think we would consider it of our fact we've been here since all day and even trying to hurry things along, but I think perhaps that's
One sentence in there which may give you some trouble, is one that we have taken from other statutes in terms of the common practice, but it does create problems, is that computer data shall be provided in a form determined by the public body. The problem of people want computer data in another form, another one the body has available. May require reprogramming, things of that nature. This is the language that has been used in most state statutes, and that's about all we have to recommend. We frankly do not have any reasonable alternative to offer. Furthermore, the agency may establish a charge to recover its actual cost.
Question?
Yeah.
Why in the language online is bound to give them? I've never seen that in statute before. Can you just be shall?
I agree.
Line 8 is bound to be shall. Shall provide.
Shall give.
Which way do you want
it? Shall give him. John, you agree with me? Matt,
quick.
What's that? You want to go jump off this?
Believe me, if we spent many hours with this bill, we would do it too.
I'm glad to know that once in a while you do make a mistake,
please. Mr. Chairman, the only other question I have is the reference to the certified copy. This generally requires then a comparison of the original with the copy by the clerk or whatever.
Right. If they want a certified copy, the agency's got to provide it to them.
Nothing to foreclose them just giving them a copy, I understand, if they just want a copy.
No, but if he wants a certified copy, all right, we'll certify him. But likewise, we are entitled to charge them for any cost that might be incurred and have to go through the process and make sure it's certified that they actually get them back. Section 6 is the administrative review provision. And it provides for review before the Attorney General. The burden of proof is on the agency, and I think that's very important as to where that burden of proof is to prove that they do come within one of the exceptions. The exceptions are listed in Section 11. And furthermore, it provides that we will issue a decision within 3 business days from the day we receive the petition. That really is no problem. Frankly, we do not anticipate much cost involved in these review proceedings. It's really a cursory review of the documents and determination whether they come under Section 11 or not. Sections 2 and 3 merely deal with the problem of, Section 2 deals with the problem if we deny a petition, then the citizen asking for disclosure can bring an action for injunctive or declaratory relief at the Marion County Circuit Court. If we grant the petition, the agency likewise could get a petition for appeal in the court. Section 3 deals with
question,
problems.
Mr. Chairman.
We have a couple of bills
in the judiciary to allow attorney's fees to the party who has to file suit. In other words, if the Attorney General enters an opinion, for example, that public documents should be disclosed and the agency refuses, and it's necessary for the party to file suit, they have a bill that provides for attorney's fees in case he is successful. Do you feel it perhaps should be built into this?
Section 9.3, Jenny Cole.
Take care of that.
The person seeking the right to inspect or receive a copy of the public record prevails, but we shall be awarded a reasonable attorney's fee.
Good. I'm glad to see you informing the future law.
I have to feel very strongly that citizen prevails, he should get them. Section 8 is probably quite critical in accounting review procedure. It does not, in this case, this is the case of an elected official. For example, the governor, secretary of state, state superintendent.
Really, it's just 7, is there a reason for that?
Section 7 provides, provides in the case of local agencies, local government agencies, the district attorney will have the same review function that the attorney general would have with respect to state agencies. Section 8.
You leave out the city attorney entirely.
Right. For the reason that, well, again, we were trying to pick one official at the local level who would be in a somewhat independent status. I put it from the standpoint he's independent, from the standpoint he's independently elected. That, from a practical standpoint, if he denies access, if he rules in favor of the agency to deny access to that record, and then gets overruled in court, he's got a political embarrassment to deal with. And that's the only reason why I likewise say that the state attorney general is in this position as far as the state goes. Because there is a very practical influence upon me to try to call him very straight, or indeed, and to actually want to call him in favor of the citizen petitioning for documents. Very reason that I don't want to be put in a position that I was overruled by the court. The district attorney is a locally elected official.
You couldn't have the city attorney to rule on the city.
Well, the city attorney is not.
Currently, he's going to have. Currently, the city attorney is going to have to represent the city because you provided the mini suit filed. Circuit Court, the district attorney shall not serve as counsel for the public body unless he ordinarily serves as counsel for it. He would not serve as counsel for the city.
Well, everything told we were trying to take care of two problems here. One, first place, many district attorneys do not even represent the county anymore in civil matters. They're represented by counsel. But where they do represent the county, they would. Then they may have a conflict of interest. If, for example, the same thing at the state level, if I rule against the agency, then that agency should be entitled to go out and get its own counsel to represent it on that matter, which is in direct conflict. I render an opinion, an opposite decision on that state court. And that's what I'm trying to take care of.
Yeah, the only, problem I can see is if the district attorney rules in favor of the public body, then the city attorney has to get to sustain that in his suit that's filed.
Right, yeah, very good. The only thing is, though, I don't think the city attorney is in a position to give an objective or an outside administrative decision on whether the city council's property and withhold that document or not.
They probably asked the city attorney's opinion prior to it, haven't they?
Very likely. They probably asked my opinion prior to it also.
George or anybody, any section you're not sure of, just make a check and we'll go back on the work session.
I'd like to repeat. The administrative review provisions in here are not perfect because it's very difficult to find anybody in government who is in a totally independent status. But on the other hand, I think it's very important from a citizen standpoint that they be given some kind of remedy at this level. Because once he has to go into court, too often it just isn't worth the cost. Now, Section 8 also raises a contract question. And if you force it down my throat, I will accept it. But I want to know that I propose Section 8.
You oppose it?
No, that I propose it. This deals with the question of where the record is, the record of an elected example of the governor. Or the superintendent of education of the Bureau of Labor. In that case, we have provided that there is no administrative review. The only way you can get a review is to go directly into court. And the reason for this is we felt that it just creates a conflict between either the district attorney and locally elected officials, or in my own case, between my office and the governor, or another elected official. And that was the reason we provided it.
Any questions on that? Okay.
All right, Section 9 is primarily procedural, re-emphasizing where the burden of proof is, emphasizing that if it does go into court, judicial review of it, it takes precedence on the docket, and finally there is attorney's fees if the citizen prevails. Section 10 merely sets forth in statutory form the form of petition. We want to make it as simple a form as possible for administrative review. And presumably, in the administrative review proceedings, I would get this one-page petition on my desk. We would ask the agency, we might not have to go this far, but ask the agency to send over the documents that were in question. We quickly go look at them and we decide one way or the other. The reading should not take much time. And the statute is very clear that I can't take more than 3 days.
Question. Lee, in Section 9, line 31 on page 4. It speaks to the court having jurisdiction to join the public body. How does that fit in with the claim of privilege to the elected official?
Here, the elected official's privilege doesn't mean anything. It only means as to the administrative proceeding before me or the district attorney.
Section 8 and 9?
Right. Section 8 merely says if a citizen files a petition with me for disclosure of records in the executive department, the governor says those records are under my control and I claim privilege to them, then I immediately say, we will not take jurisdiction in this case. Then the citizen's only recourse is to the court. The court determines it on the basis of the merits of the argument, not whether he's going to the commission.
Well, my question was, if line 31 says the court has jurisdiction to enjoin the public body, it doesn't speak to the public official.
The public body includes every state officer, agency, department, so forth.
So that's in your definition.
Section 8 is not intended to give any kind of privilege to an elected official except from another elected official at the administrative level. Is that clear?
All right.
Section 11. We read it, and this is where we get down to the difficult problem of defining the exception. Section 11.1a. First of all, I'd like you to compare that with. John, where do we repeal the executive privilege? Section 13? Yeah. Section 13 is an amendment to ORS 44040, and this has been a big loophole in the present public records law, which provides that a public officer shall not be examined as communications made to him an official confidence and the public interest that suffered by the disclosure. We are repeating that provision. It's far too broad in our opinion, because it leaves up to the public officer to determine on his own judgment what is a confidential communication and what is not. We have, however, entered the privilege within 11.1a that deals with oral communications between government employees and their superiors. The point is here is to permit a qualified privilege, which is subject to a balancing of interest test between the public interest in disclosure, between the public interest in encouraging frank communications between employees. And I can best give you an example of this. I'm just simply taking the types of communications I get from my own people in my office. It's not the formal memorandum, but rather the one-line memorandum that says, frankly, this case is a lousy case, or some other more graphic term. And if we totally discourage, if all that type of thing becomes immediately available on just request by anybody to public inspectors, I think we create a habit in government of not keeping records, and frankly, everything starts to become oral, and we have all kinds of problems with the result. I think there is a policy of trying to encourage this type of frank communication. The only kind of communication will be of an advisory nature, and which we're not involved in a final decision. Subsection B deals with public records, which are matters related to matters that are in litigation. The only reason for granting this exemption simply is that if we did not have this exemption, government would be put at a severe disadvantage in any litigation, because all these records, of course, are available and accessible through the litigation process to the ordinary rules of discovery and statutes that deal with discovery. But we do have occasion where attorneys try to beat the discovery rules and come into us under the public records law and try to get in our records, and we don't get any neutrality or any chance to get any discovery for their records. That is the reason for that provision. Subsection C deals with information that can't contain in personnel files, primarily medical files and similar files. And in broad terms, it is whether the question of whether the public disclosure of there would constitute an unreasonable invasion of personal privacy. But this would protect most personnel records. It protects them from an outsider coming in and looking at those personnel records. It does not protect them from the person who is the subject of the record. When I came into office, we had a dispute with the Welfare Division over this subject. They were relying on federal regulations on state statutes to deny welfare recipients from an opportunity to look at their own files while they were denied a grant. The reason for that law was to protect personal privacy. Well, obviously, you're not going to aim at personal privacy to consider the subject of the file. But the outside interloper from coming in, yes, there is a legitimate protection. Yeah.
If the records were relative to a suit, and if it was sued by an individual, he would be entitled to look at his own individual records.
Right.
And then going back...
Likewise, an employee should have a right to have access to his personnel record anyway.
Is there any possible conflict with B on that if the records are part of the litigation?
Likely conflicts are not real, because if he is asking for, well, okay, if it's part of litigation, theoretically, under the statute, we could withhold it until he makes a motion for discovery. We'd have to deliver it right away. Now, let me make one fine point, just to confuse you, if I may, on personnel records. It is the present policy, and it would be a policy that could be upheld under subsection D of the Personnel Division, to not reveal to an employee any information received from a former employer where that information was delivered to Congress.
And the reason for that is the former employer delivered that information in confidence. He was not required by law to provide that information. And consequently, it could be withheld under those reasons. That's subsection D.
All right, what you're saying then is that the governmental agency can go through the employee's 201 file, pull parts of it out before allowing the employee to see it.
We can, right. From the standpoint, if we had a personnel file and we had in there, say, a letter from a former employer, and the former employer said we are providing this information there in common, then we could withhold the last document. On that basis. Now, let me mention that subsection D is qualified privilege. If a court determines that that personnel, that letter, is of sufficient importance, then we still have to review.
We're assuming that whoever is pulling the documents from the 201 file is completely honest and is not pulling anything out that might be detrimental to the agency or himself.
Right, he has two ways to, the only way he can test it, if he's not in litigation. Okay, he doesn't believe he's getting the full file. He files a decision in my office and has to turn over the whole record. All right, we try to cover it in the appeal of the court. No absolute guarantee, you're right. Subsection E is designed to cover a number of a common exemption that you see in every public records law. It is one that is also designed to cover a series of statutes that we presently have. I mentioned already the Department of Geology, drilling detail. These are trade secrets, as distinguished from patents or things of that matter, information which would be of great value to competitors and business information that is provided to government. Subsection F deals with investigatory information for criminal law purposes, and I think everybody understands why that should remain confidential. In fact, I think we are probably drawing statutes now to make sure that it gets confidential. Subsection G deals with test questions, scoring fees used by your licensing boards, and those types of things.
What about, excuse me, Lee, what about rating of professors by students?
I think that, John, excuse me, I have to refer back by
counsel. Bring him up if you want to.
John, what about me? Is that covered by one of the statutes in here?
Sit down, John, and be comfortable.
Well, yeah. We did not consider it, Chairman, now, to the extent that it's covered under subsection D, where there's information that is not required by law to be given, but it's given in confidence, and then the agency is entitled to remove it in confidence, unless compelled to reveal it by the court.
Well, should it be considered further than a considerable push in this area at the present time, I think it would be
successful. I don't think there's no requirement for students to buy that kind of information. So it can be covered in D, if they want it.
No requirement for whom to provide that information? For students to provide that information?
Right.
Well, but what I have in mind is the rating of a university professor that's turned into his department head by the students.
I don't think the student, there's no law that the student has to provide that information. They can ask for that information to the student. And they can agree that any information provided will be held in confidence. And now we come under subsection D.
Okay.
Section I.
H.
Or H, pardon me. Okay, this is designed to cover a whole series of statutes, particularly the Department of Agriculture, and also some of your revenue statutes, production data, sale data, catch records, fish commission. These are records that are kept solely for the purpose of determining a fee. They are essentially really kind of trade secrets. Our information then are presently kept confidential under other statutes. We've repealed most of the statutes and brought into this broader language. Subsection I. There was one, most statutes relate to all matters dealing with the purchase of real estate. We did not feel that was justified. We did, however, feel that the state should be able to keep the confidentiality of its appraisals. Actually, our present practice is record profiting on those appraisals, but we don't like to have a one-way street.
In that same regard, Lee, what about bid contracts and this one? Is that covered elsewhere?
Simply with the public record once the bids are open.
Once the bids are open, nobody can construe this to force somebody to reveal a bid prior to the opening.
Chairman, you may have raised a question, but we better take a quick look at. John says he has looked at it. He's taking a double check on that. Any public records or information disclosure of which is prohibited by federal law or regulations is obvious. 137.
Time.
Should it be added to Section J or other state law?
We have tried, Representative Cole, to list all those in subsection M.
How about the county and city ordinance?
We have tried to limit them all to subsection M.
Sure, you think of a tough one, and when we get to M, you see it's there.
M of what?
It's on the next page.
Oh, on the next page.
But 25 cents.
Check it out.
We did not think that the county would give them the power to determine on that hot baseline. That's a policy question that you may want to address. 137, subsection K refers to free sentence. Subsection L deals with information in the corrections division, parole board. The extent of that information doesn't interfere with the rehabilitation process.
All these others are listed in lowercase, Grant. Will you make sure that we're going to rewrite them in lowercase?
Subsection M. Related to jury statutes, and I include those statutes with you. Give me just a half a second. And some of these amendments we have and go through the ORS 1.440 refers to proceedings before the papers filed with the Judicial Specimen Commission.
So how are we going to tie this in, Lee? Where are you exactly?
I'm on subsection M of
1.5. And does that relate in any way to the other pages you mentioned?
No, these are just just listing other statutory sections that are permitted exclusion. Okay. No others would be permitted.
So the amendments you've given, Mr. Chairman, the amendments 2 and 3?
Right, it would add some sections to that.
They'd all go in M?
Right. Most of them.
Also, you've missed some amendments that are back on page 7. It's your amendments 4 and 5.
Right. If I can get through section 11, Chairman, then I'll take you through the amendments.
All right.
Actually, the remaining sections of the bill are all technical. 1.440 is Judicial Fitness Commission. 7211 and 7215 are adoption and affiliation proceedings. 44040 is your privilege communication. Question whether that section is even needed, but we put it in. 146.780 is injury reports received by medical examiners. 173.230 is matters brought before legislative council. 179.495.
Why legislative council?
Some legislators prefer when they make a request to the council will be kept confidential.
This one's the reason for the proliferation of bills.
I don't wish to make any comments. $179.495 is medical histories of inmates in the same institution. $181.540 Central Bureau of Criminal Investigation. 306, 314, 2835, 40 are tax records. 336.195 and 351.065 are student records. 411.320 are public assistance records, which are required by federal law to be confidential, but may also the federal law requires to be an affirmative statute. 411.770 is child abuse reports and records. 419.567 is juvenile court proceedings. 432.1060 is patient records and morbidity stats and studies. 432 is legitimate patient and registration of foundlings. 474.160 is prescription records. 655 is unemployment insurance records, which are again required by federal law to be kept confidential.
Subsection 3 on page
8. Well, it'd be better off just to remove those that don't want and then leave all the rest of them on the books so you don't inadvertently forget one.
Well, what we did, Mr. Chairman, is what we have done is what we did last session on the Administrative Procedures Act.
Now, if we have this so often, that we spend one third of our time down here, each session trying to take care of things just like this that were forgotten. And we do waste an awful lot of time. You talk about this proliferation bill, but a good share of it is just trying to correct something that was flipped up last time. We have hundreds of these little bills.
Well, I think part of the problem, though, is that we have a proliferation of statutes in the field. A good deal of them are not good. But also, we have the same argument. Same argument was presented with respect to the Administrative Procedures Act. And we provided, and it was my investigation and was provided, that if we discover during the interim there is some class of records that we have overlooked, an application can be made to the governor. And we can appoint only me. In other words, to keep it at the highest political level where it's right out in the open. Right out the open. To make a review and make recommendations, and then he makes a decision. We have had only one review of that, the Administrative Procedures Act, which is the governor. got to approve corrections last session. And this is an escape hatch provision, which is put on the governor's office.
Well, that goes back to
the cover any mistakes we made.
Question on line 27, page 7, if you had a state law there. Would that help the situation?
Where? I don't think it's necessary. And we prefer to avoid it. Over the years, Mr. Chairman, we have made as careful a review as we can. We've put the word out to the agencies three times now, and I really don't think we've made any mistakes. We may possibly have made a mistake. The escape hatch is provided in subsection 3 on page 8. The governor can exempt a class of records. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, we have found an awful lot of statutes where it might have been where people have managed to get confidentiality in some very broad language. It doesn't mean anything. You could drive a railroad car right through the school wall. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Sorry. Well, we come to a work session, Jonathan, I presume you'll be prepared to defend yourself against the co-chairman.
But I really think, Senator Ripper, if you read subsection 3, it does provide any class of records, say, look, you goofed, these records should be examined. You hold the hearing, you're in jail, you're appointed me to hold the hearing. And then it has to be reviewed by the legislature the next day. I think you're going to carry out the real purpose of this bill. You've got to make it that sound. Chairman, now going to the amendment. From amendment number 2 first. This merely adds some tax statutes that we need to overlook and also make sure that there's no pass-through effect on those tax returns. So they are given to another agency pursuant to their statute. Amendment number 3 is designed to take care of the banking commissioner's problem. He has testified to you. We think that we have taken care of his objections. He is out of town. Very broad exemption between the device. Section 4 is really designed to clarify the exemption dealing with police reports. It made clear that arrest reports are the reports that a crime is committed are not counted. But essential to investigating the person. Section 5 is merely clarifying language regarding the confidentiality of records dealing with the assessment of fees. This is an amendment we worked out with the Department of Agriculture. Section 6, we amended the testimonial privilege to make clear that a public official cannot be examined as to records that are otherwise exempt. In other words, I cannot be subpoenaed to testify as to records which would be confidential under the statute. Is that reasonably clear? Amendment 7 is designed to take care of the problem raised by debates in previous hearings relating to birth certificates. We had originally suggested this provision be repealed. And with our opinion, his testimony was very compelling. There are
in their confidentiality. Amendment number 8 merely deals with accident reports filed with the Motor Vehicle Division. The policy of the law is to keep them confidential, to not permit their use in court, really. On the thought that we rule on the canon reports, if they do something like matters to be used in litigation. The policy considerations behind that policy are questionable, but I don't think it's worth bothering to get into them. Amendment number 9 deals with the Public Employees Relations Board. These are records that are not presently confidential under statute, but we think probably should be. They are under the laws of the National Labor Relations Board and all through the area of collective bargaining. These are the names, the signatures of employees, sign authorization cards, or petitions for the purpose of requesting representation for decertification elections. The employees are otherwise sign of the subject to coercion, feeling that they should be protected, much like the ballot. The insurance, amendment number 10, deals with the insurance commissioner and our primary protected investigative material, and also the name of the person who filed a complaint. Amendment number 11, as I mentioned, amendments to take care of certain records from the State Industrial Access Fund. As I understand, Mr. Gill is here, and I would prefer to let him testify on that point. As I said, one either in opposition or in support of those amendments. Amendment number 12, I would hold aside if any deals with questions. If you want to qualify or eliminate the idea of administrative review, amendment number 12 is comprehensive. And 15 deals with investigatory information to state fire marshal.
Do you have a recommendation on which of these you think should be secret?
Chairman, we have agreed with the agency's amendments, all these amendments, other than amendment 11. We agree with the agency they shouldn't remain confidential.
You would argue then on behalf of any of these except the.
Number 11, I think there are very strong arguments in favor of the State Industrial Action Fund confidential, but on the other side of it, they're basically a record which deals with the fund's competitive position with other insurance companies. On the other side of it, the fund does enjoy certain advantages with the state agencies. Maybe it ought to also have the opposite. Those are the issues.
If Mr. Gill argues in favor of it, would it be fair to let you argue again?
No, I would not argue again.
Chairman, how about 12?
12 is was merely if
you don't favor 12.
No. Let me answer this way, Mr. Control. I think there is no statute in the nation that I know of that has any kind of administrative review provision for public records. And yet this is the one criticism that we have pulled out of the people who have written the studies considerably. I would tell you there's one big hole that all public records laws have. We tried to work out a solution to that situation. I think it would be worthwhile to try it for a couple of years and see how it works out. Maybe even one of those put an additional proviso in there that I make a report to the next legislature as to what has been the outcome. How many cases have we had? How many, what has been the result of those cases and so forth? I'd be glad to do that. But it's a central problem with most administrators, with most public records.
Please, in a nutshell,
which records have been opened up under the amendment and the bill? Right? I think we have repealed most of the ones I don't think we have added. Well, we've added a few, but the decertification and were just an matter of they have been regarded as confidential. They really, and the agencies didn't have any legal authority to withhold them. They were doing it anyway. I think the bill is perhaps more significant by the number that we have repealed, and by getting rid of the idea that an agency really can make a subjective determination whether it's subject to closure.
You mean repeal confidentiality?
Right.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, give me a list.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed part of your waiting meeting.
We have 14 statutes that we have repealed. In addition, we had the continual problem that we get in our office. Does the name of the agency rely on, I think it was section under the ORS section 44, which is the executive privilege, relying on that, and which is a kind of a very loose test of balancing of interest, and gives the agency the initial determination. And I think probably the repeal of that is more important than anything else. Mr. Papadopoulos is here. You can tell you more about that. But in his case, I had, I'll be very frank, Canada, I recommended the agency. I said that I do not think he can prevail. On the other side, the agency had some merit to its argument. And the Attorney General, I had a duty, therefore, to advance it. So when the Oregon Supreme Court has been civil defense, Mr. Papadopoulos can prevail.
Okay, ladies, ready to go on through the rest of it, or can make it call?
Mr. Chair, I really don't think, I can keep you here all night going through the rest of these sections, but they are really technical amendments, conforming statutes to the first 11 sections.
Let me ask you on page 9, line 6, every public body, is that the way we want to say that, or should that be governing body?
Section 12 would go out.
It's all out.
Yeah, that's public record. Yeah. Good public record.
Question, do we have a problem with all the city charters that exist around the state? Seeing them properly amended to conform to this?
I don't think you have any problem at all with things, Cole. Just the legislature is not the legislature on the subject. It's not a statewide concern. And it's just the need to discharge it.
You think you've spoken
you can
in this bill to all
attorneys, and you may have. Is to confine the bill and just take it.
Do you think by this bill you've spoken to all these public documents that are other than state?
I hope I have, yes. I can't think of any unique set of records that the city council sees or the county commission sees that are entitled to confidentiality.
Thank you.
completed on trade with them. Section 14, which is present law, it's amended over here in the...
Page 11?
Yeah, amended on page 12.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
Repeating.
Hey, Mark?
Repeating. This has been the crutch, Chairman, that agencies have been able to use and seal records. Now, we do, I should say we are repeating it. We have modified that by amendment number 20. Amendment number 6. That a public officer shall not be examined as a public record exempt from the disclosure of that.
Section 14, on page 11, starts on page 11.
Section 14. Public to their competitors, or possibly to somebody else wanting to know information about their business. So we are concerned from that aspect of our relationship with the employer and this kind of private information. Secondly, we're concerned about the information that might be requested from our competition in these areas. One of the other areas, or the second area that we're concerned about that the amendment, I believe, speaks directly to, is in the area of dividends. That writing workers' compensation insurance in this state that all carriers are required to use the same method of charging rates and the same experience rating, the competition comes in the manner in which the dividends are extended to the employers. Each carrier has their own secret dividend formula, and it's highly confidential. It is only understandable from an actuarial standpoint to another insurance carrier. And it's the type of thing that you use in order to develop a competitive profile. Not being able to keep this type of information confidential would seriously jeopardize the competitive position of the fund. It also, I think, would jeopardize the cost factor, I think, of working with compensation insurance in the state of Oregon because of that. It would allow, for instance, a particular carrier to come in to analyze the dividend formula and schedule and develop a formula that would direct itself to a specific block of business that was desirable for him that would competitively possibly be harmed by knowing beforehand what we might do. I suppose it's the same basis that bids are developed on. You change your dividend formula each year, you know, kind of keep everybody guessing. Those are the two areas we're concerned about. We feel there are concerns. We feel there are concerns that protect not only the employers, the state, but also the program of working compensation. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Any questions?
Have you seen the amendment?
I haven't seen the amendment to Mr. Johnson. I saw the draft and he worked out the staff in the noon, and I presume that
are any of the records of your competitors open to you in these areas?
No, they're not. These areas are considered, again, confidential in the insurance industry. The only way that the competitor gets this information, that we file this information, of course, under control of the insurance commissioner and also the Workers' Compensation Board. Third agency, called the Rating Bureau or National Council, collects the employer information, and it's not in the specific form that we collected, but the information on policy, date, ending, experience rating. In order for another carrier to get information about an account, they have to have authorization from the employer that you can get this information, and then it's given to them, not by the individual carrier, but by just that information that's given to the National Council, but only upon authorization of the employer. It does not include the payroll information, only experience rating and total premium pay.
Are you an expert in this field, Mr. Bates?
I know enough about it to scare me.
You might scare the committee, I won't call you. Anything else, Mr. Gill? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is not intended to be an open hearing. The closed meeting bill is not yet passed. If there's anybody from out of town, however, Mike, do you want to testify?
My name is Mike Papadopoulos. I'm from Gravani. I've been intending to testify right through the history of this hearing. I'm not as prepared as I ought to be because there was some confusion as to the time of this particular session, or rather as to whether this particular session would be open to me or not. So I'm just going to highlight some of the points that I remember that I cannot have on my notes. I'd like to send in some written material later. One item stands apart from everything else. Most of my speaking will be in terms of section 11. But if we go back to section 5, it stands by itself. We're talking about computer data. At that point, the mere fact that the Attorney General has found this particular language in the statutes of other jurisdictions, to me, doesn't seem quite good enough. I have to know something about computers. I also have to know something about the public body. And I do not like the thought that the public body will determine which is the most convenient forum of computer output for me to use. There's been one case gone through the courts already in this kind of area, and you'll see the kind of problem. This is a case where the county clerk, I think in one of the New Mexico districts, was asked to provide information, voter registration information. And he provided it in one way and in only one way, namely printed out computer material. One of the parties, I don't know which one of the parties, was interested in having that material in the most convenient form so that he might sort out the voters' names, to its own convenience, perhaps by alphabetically, perhaps by sex, perhaps by street. It likely what the demand was for the material to be provided in usable form, either on punch cards or on magnetic tape. So that the party who was asking for the information might then pay for its own computer to sort out the material and use it to the best advantage. The point there was that the information was already public. The information was already in the public computer, and the court said it was not for the clerk to say which way was the best way for the public to receive that information. Each computer is capable of turning out information in a number of different ways. It all depends on which button you push. It may depend on a slight, small amount of program. The person wishing to know what is in the computer in a particular program is able to describe that program. He may ask for it to be printed out for him in alphabetical order. He may ask for it to be provided for him on a magnetic tape. He may ask if the computer is capable for it to be provided to him on punch cards or in one of the various possible ways. And so the language that I would like to see, rather than allowing the public body to determine which form the data shall be provided in, I would like to see it say that the data shall be provided in a form suitable to the computer, in any form suitable to the computer, at the request of the person seeking the information, and I would put in a payment. Printout costs money, magnetic tape costs money, punch card cost money. I think that the person seeking that information is entitled to use the fact that that information is already at public expense being placed in the computer. Some clerk has taken raw material collected by people, turned it into punch cards, turned it into machine usable information. And I would like to see the public deprived of the best work that has been done. Now I turn to Mr. Section 11. You will remember, and I think you'll be well to dwell on the cases which have already been heard in this state. I'm not going to dwell on my own case because we don't already mention it, but there's been one really big case in this state on public records. It's perhaps the leading case in the whole of the United States. It came out in 1962. This really was a determinative court decision that public records were in general wide open, not the tiny records under unless there was a particular case. And so we come into this section 11, and I think the spirit is all right, but it gets a little bit too complicated for my mind. I think the repetition in the about public interest goes in two directions. I would try to keep the burden of proving confidentiality. I would place the burden of maintaining confidentiality, if that is to be kept, on the agency. I wouldn't want to see the member of the public crying out and saying the public interest lies in my being able to see this information. So, I would, if I were writing this bill, I would delete the first qualifier in section 11.1 and saying purely and simply the following public records are exempt from disclosure. And these qualifiers are individual sections of the individual kind of state. In the first place, what your agency is called upon to do as it stands now is to say, well, we have a public record in one of these lower classes, A, B, C, D, F, and G. Are we, the public agency, going to decide that the public interest, even though we want them to be exempt, are we, the agency, the right people to decide that the public interest really requires disclosure? I'm not sure that the public agency is in the best position to do that. Certainly, I appreciate the Attorney General coming in and putting himself above the public agencies as a different kind of officer, public officer, more answerable to public opinion, more answerable to what the law actually says. But I don't think the agency should be bearing the burden of saying, pretending that it's really going honestly to look at a particular document and say, we want to keep it confidential, but really, it opens your conflict. I don't see any agency doing that. And that's what that first section is calling upon me to do. I think in section C, I've changed the language. I don't like the loose language of what is an unreasonable invasion of personal privacy. I think it's very fine to see that the legislature should support privacy in the right place, in the proper place. And I would, but I don't like this word of unreasonable. And I prefer to see language like information to be exempt unless the public interest, by clear and convincing evidence, requires it. Putting much more of a burden on the agency to say, No, because that's for a court to decide. Section D is the most important one, because Section D appears to be a replacement for the privilege section which has been repealed, 44.04.0.B, the official privilege section. In my opinion, this particular language is worse than the one that it's replacing. It shifts the burden completely to the members of the public to show that the public interest clearly outweighs the public and private interest in non-disclosure, which the public agency is trying to maintain. And it still doesn't meet the problems which are available in the existing provision, the existing statute, as to what and who is really being protected by the confidentiality provision. There is one kind of confidentiality which is well known, and I think it would be better to refer to it specifically. It's traditional. It's the protection of the informer, the person with information who wishes to give information for police use. The public interest in protecting his identity is well known, is well worth preserving. That informer privilege ought to stand out by itself very, very visibly as a thing that's well protected. But it's not the information that's being protected, it's the informant. The information will come out in court eventually, if there's a case to be made. But the court appears to maintain a policy generally of protecting the name of the original informant in case it's going to be maltreated or mistreated in some way. But then you come to the question which is mixed in with this is the kind of question which I come across in which the name of the informer or of a consultant is perfectly well known, but the information that you wish to give may be confidential. And I think the legislature should be looking very, very, very carefully at what kind of information it might be that the public agency is seeking from a consultant, probably a non-consultant. Which it wishes to keep secret. The kind of information I can give you a model, if you like, where you have a bridge or some public structure in which it is thought that it might fall down, and the state sends out for a consulting report on the stability of that structure. And they go to the very finest consultant in the land, and they pay him money. And he comes along and says, this bridge is about to fall down. And in order to prevent panic, there is a public interest in preventing panic. The agency concerned might very well say, let's treat see this report come to issue. We have the very best interest of the public in mind. We will repair that bridge. We will repair that bridge. So let's keep it secret in case of the time. And so there is a distinction between the author of the possibly confidential information, the information itself, whether it should be confidential or not. And then finally, the other end. Who is it? When, if you admit that there has been the confidentiality somewhere, who is it that's going to demand it? With the informer in the criminal matter, I think it's reasonably well established that the informer comes along and says, I will give you this information to keep my name on it. At the same time, the DA or the court appears to go along with that protection. I'm not sure if it's the DA or the court which offer that confidentiality or whether it's the informer that demands it. But in the other kind of situations where there is not an informer, you apparently have an official within the state offices who thinks he's able to say, you tell me something, I will offer you confidentiality. Either to your name, I think that's going to be appropriate, but the material that you give me. And that's the point I'm very curious about. I don't see that any state officer should be going around and saying, if you tell me something that you know, an opinion, an advisory opinion, that you should be able to count on that opinion. And so all the time we come back to those points having been made, we come back to the point of where is the person to be punished by this station. I'm trying to have this community that the burden should be on the agency to explain why it does not want disclosure. Not that the agency should be there trying to say that the disclosure is worthwhile in some cases and not enough. Very fine distinction. Let me just hold on a minute. I've got a lot of notes here, and then there's that section A. I see a troublesome point in the idea that by classifying documents as advisory and preliminary final action, the public official may in fact be covering up. Again, we haven't yet got to the point where the Attorney General is the final decider. If the final, if the Attorney General is in fact going to be involved, that's probably not the best thing. But at this particular point, if that section went in by itself, I would see the possibility that the public official might be trying to protect something against the public interest, just by labeling a document. By essentially classifying. I've used the phrase in various other places that there's no official secret act. There's no official secret act in the United States except if you have to do military security and foreign affairs. Law and Oregon is not in the military business or in the foreign affairs business. I don't see any place for official secret as such. This legislature gives express confidentiality to those things that think are worthwhile. And privacy and all those statutes which are listed, and I don't think we should do any further than that. I talked about the informer. Who supplied the information? Yes. I think that's enough for tonight.
All right, Mike, if you'd like to condense your remarks, then
I just found
in writing, I'll be fine. Do any members of the committee have any questions?
That's
Section 9. Except for retroactivity. Okay, thank you, Mike. Does anybody else wish to appear contrary to the committee's wishes at this time? The preliminary hearing on 2157 is closed, and we'll go to Senate Bill 15, but we'll have a 5-minute recess while we're trying to round up some more of our members.
The committee stands ready for that, and those elements of the board meeting have to do with discussions of matters that relate to clinical review of patient care in a public hospital. I might remind you that there are about 25 such hospitals in the state, district, county, and city. The clinical committees of the medical staff range in name far and wide, and that's why the language, including but not limited to, is in there. Almost every hospital has a surgery committee, a medical committee, an obstetrical committee, an infections committee, tissue committee, and so forth. But there are a variety of other committees that all relate to the clinical aspects of the hospital. These are matters which we think should be encouraged. They're done in the interest of the patient. They're done to maintain good quality care in the hospital. And they're done to protect the patient or the public, if you will. To discourage this kind of activity would be adverse to the interest of the bill, I believe. Adverse, at least, to the interest of people promoting the bill. We do not object to the public, to the meeting, rather, the public body, the board meeting being open to the public. We're suggesting, however, that particular part of that meeting that does relate to the medical competency or the professional competency or relates to medical matters be taken up in executive session. So we've offered an amendment to Section 6. The amendment would be placed on line, or following line 6 of page 4, and I believe it's self-explanatory, speaks to these things which are just related. Now, with no more explanation than that, if I can answer questions, I'll be happy to.
Could you go through each one of the items that you listed there? You mentioned the clinical committee.
Yes.
What do you mean by executive?
Well, almost every medical staff has an executive committee, which kind of handles the business of the medical staff, relates to revisions or bylaws and that sort of thing. They might have a special committee relating to the executive committee. The credentials committee investigates the credentials of doctors seeking admission to the medical staff and seeking a change in privileges awarded to them. Again, these are areas routinely held highly confidential. And the reason for it is to encourage other hospital medical staff and so forth to respond honestly to a query about the physician's performance in another hospital.
What's utilization review?
Well, with the advent of Title 18 Medicare, there came a federal requirement that each patient who is in the hospital beyond X many days, and I believe it's 14, have his records subjected to the scrutiny of a utilization review committee, and that committee is to make determination as to whether or not continued or further hospital care is needed. If the committee says no, in our judgment, no further hospital care is needed, then the Medicare payment is discontinued 72 hours following that time. The attending physician has the right to go back and appeal, if I can use that term, to the Utilization Review Committee. A peer review committee is a committee of physicians looking at physicians and assessing their professional competence. And peer review, by virtue of Public Law 92603, which was Social Security Amendment to the last Congress, will be done on a different basis probably hereafter. I say probably because certain hospital peer review committees would withstand the test of the federal law and would be permitted to continue to operate in that area. But it will change the nature of that. It may or may not be institutionally based in the future.
Are there any questions?
Your comments only apply to public hospitals.
That's true. That information now is confidential and all.
Thank you very much.
The intent spelled out here is strictly to the functions of the medical staff and not the hospital board.
Yeah, I think section on page 4. At line 29, subsection 5, where it says no executive session may be held for the purpose of taking any final action or making any final decision, assures that the action that the board of directors, for instance, of the district hospital would take relating to medical matters would be probably one of two types. First of all, that board would review privileges granted to medical staff members annually and either restrictive privileges or or deny further privileges, or in most cases, renew the privileges of each individual medical staff member. The other type of information would be, or the other type of decision would relate to the physician who had been found wanting of professional competency, had been through the hearing process, and had been, in fact, in his last term, found guilty. And for that reason, the board was discontinuing his medical staff privileges. That kind of action would have to be made according to subsection 5 and be open to the public portion of the board meeting and would therefore be public knowledge. I'm not suggesting that the reason behind it would necessarily be offered at that time, but at least the decision would be made at that time.
On this question of executive, I missed that, and I'd like to know exactly, is there another word to be used there? Is there something that we're going to use executive session for an executive meeting?
Well, no. The executive committee of the medical staff functions and handles the business of the medical staff. It relates, for instance, to rules and regulations of the medical staff, bylaws, changes that might be upcoming. Has to do with whether or not the hospital should spend $40,000 for a week, because whether or not they're going to recommend to the board that that be the case. Almost any set of bylaws, medical staff bylaws, would bring to the executive committee any charge against the physician, indicating, for instance, the surgery committee says that Dr. X has too high a normal tissue rate. That would go to the executive committee, from there the medical staff, from there the board.
Wouldn't it be easier to take out committees, which is all clinical committees, and take out committees, say all clinical executive credentials, utilization review, peer review committee?
Well,
and then you say you define that as an executive committee.
I say it at the outset, or I said at the outset, that there are a number of committees which I have not included here. That do function. I'm sure I couldn't come up with all the names used by medical staff in the state of Oregon. There are blood transplant committees, there are blood committees, transfusion committees, there are transplant committees where those things are done, there are formulary committees and all sorts of committees, but are all clinical in nature, and I think that term covers it.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go, and I'd like to put in my 2 cents for it if I can. I object very strongly to the exclusion of the hospital, and for the reasons that I stated before. And on page 4 of Senate Bill 15, of subsection D at the top of the page, it's been pointed out to me by very responsible legal counsel that the word staff member would include most of the problems that he's concerned about. And I think I objected to the change of shall to may before. So if you want to, are you changing that back? Is that the motion?
Not on his.
Other one. Yeah. And I think that would be very good, and I would vote for that. And I also would vote for the elimination of the legal conference. I have to.
Are you giving somebody on the committee your proxy?
I'll give Ms. Cole my proxy.
Fine.
But and I won't vote against the bill if you elect to exclude the hospitals, but I think that they should not be excluded for all the reasons that we went through before. But if that's the way it comes out of committee, I'll still support it.
Thank you. I know you've got a problem down there.
We discussed this matter of staff member reference in section.
Yes.
I believe it's found in section 6, sub A. This is sub A. Can you, you don't feel that that reference there is sufficient to take care of the staff problem?
Well, I think if it says medical staff member, I feel more comfortable with it. It seems to me it is related to one who is employed on the staff of an institution. Speaking on in the frame of reference of hospitals, it does not get to the kind of situation where the ordinary physician practicing in the hospital is not an employee of the hospital. He merely has privileges to. I'm not comfortable with that language, frankly. nor does it get to the other area that I was speaking of, the public meeting concept of medical staff, its committees, and so forth. Those meetings being public, no medical staff member would be safe from public scrutiny. Professional practice. The effect probably would be to discourage this kind of challenge because of the potential for public misunderstanding. If I may, Mr. Chairman, to cite an example, if a physician, who's, let's say, the general surgeon, through the medical audit process, is determined that he has a high infection rate, and that's reported at a meeting of the surgery committee. And let's say the news people are there, and the news people report that for one reason or another in the paper. Then it's later determined that those cases which caused this infection rate to be excessive happened to be dirty cases when they came in. The first appendix which caused peritonitis, this sort of thing, and that he was not really in any way negligent or any way contributed to this thing himself. In that case, a retraction later in the newspaper, this would be ineffective, and it seems to me that surgeon would be wrong by that kind of public announcement. If he has a high infection rate and he doesn't respond in a practical way to correcting it, or if he has a high death rate or some other statistical rate and doesn't respond, then sooner or later he's going to end up through the medical staff and its process to the board and go through its hearing process. And if he's a bad guy, he's going to be restricted in his privileges or have his privileges discontinued altogether.
Any other questions? Will you introduce yourself to the microphone, please?
Yes, I'm Pete Fleischman, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Hospitals.
Thank you. Tony, do you have any comments?
No,
I don't have any, Chair. That's Attorney General. Cole, do you have a motion?
I want to move the adoption of the minutes.
As is?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Cole has amended, has moved to amend page 4, line 6, for the amendment he has reported. Is there any discussion? First, call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. Mr. Lindquist, will you take over the chair? Mr. Chairman, I move line 20 on page 4 be deleted. Mr. Chairman, I think this can be used as an excuse to close any meeting that anybody wants to close simply with the statement that, well, we're going to consult with our counsel. And I think it negates the intent of the entire legislation.
Well, I'm opposed to the. I was just trying to think of some amendment that perhaps might take care of the problem. But I do think it's an essential part of the operation of a public body, particularly those small public bodies that rely almost entirely upon their legal counsel for guidance and interpretation of the law. And, I know in my experience of serving as counsel for cities and hospital districts and other public bodies that
frequently a matter that involves potential litigation will be discussed. And I can see where the concern is here, that the public body would say, well, we're going to talk to our counsel because of the possibility of litigation. And I wonder if we can just tighten it up.
Do you have a suggestion? Mr. Chairman, does the defendant have a suggestion?
How about to consult with counsel on matters involving pending litigation?
Was that in the earlier language, something like that? How does the public know that it's pending litigation?
Well, I would interpret pending litigation as a situation where a demand has been made, if not the suit actually filed. Frequently, you'll get a letter. The city will get a letter from someone who slipped on a sidewalk, demanding payment for this. I would classify that as a matter of pending litigation, short of suit actually been filed.
Would a meeting for that be necessary? Would the city manager just come over and talk with the city attorney, or the mayor come over and talk to the city attorney? It would not be an executive meeting necessarily, nor a open meeting.
Well, that's a problem. These things usually come up in council when the correspondence is written.
We'll discuss that later, dear.
Well, how about on matters that involve litigation?
I think everything the city or county does involves litigation to some extent, one way or the other, or advice from the attorney.
No, I'm talking about litigation statute and command.
You mean to take the word may out, is that what you're saying, then, George?
I don't think so.
That involves litigation, is that what you're
saying? He says first pending litigation. Yeah, you would eliminate May too, would you not? Question on the motion, Mr. Chairman. If there's no further discussion.
Well, I'd move to amend the amendment, Mr. Chairman, to delete the words on line 20, page 4. Delete the words may involve. The words may involve and insert involve pending.
Representative Cole amends the motion to delete the words on line 20 of the may involve and replace it with involve pending.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is an improvement, but I don't think it gets really to the heart of it. I don't think it's necessary. My discussion.
Question.
Those in favor of the amendment, amendment, say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Cole?
Aye.
Representative Pollack? Do you want me to call
him?
She will die. I don't care about my question legality.
I don't think we have her. Were
you voting no for the last time?
General rule, we don't. How's that?
Representative Rally?
No.
Representative Engel?
No.
Representative Lindquist?
No. Question on the previous one.
Representative
Cole? No.
Representative
Raleigh?
Aye.
Representative
Engel? Aye.
Representative
Lindquist? Aye. Mr. Chairman, I move that section 6, sub 4, lines 25 to 28,
be amended to, as each one of us has in front of us, with the word shall substituted for the word may.
That's lines 25 and 27.
Right.
Change may to shall.
May to shall.
Is that the only change?
And
yeah,
line 27.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay.
May to shall. There's two of them in there, too.
Representative Engels moves that the word may in line 25 and line 27 of page 4 of the Senate Bill 15 be stricken and the word shall be replaced. Any questions that he has raised?
Mr. Chairman, I think it makes the whole thing relatively ineffective with the making it permissible rather than mandatory. And I can see many circumstances. I'm sure the rest of the committee can, where an arbitrary public body will discriminate against the news media in this area, and they will not be permitted in, and when there is no excuse for you to keep them out.
Who is to decide when they are the ones who are going to disclose the information?
Well, we have rules set up for executive sessions, Mr. Chairman, and I think when it shall, these rules would apply.
Not for them.
For the news media.
Under such conditions governing the disclosure of information.
Once they're there, anything they want to disclose, they can disclose.
It seems like we discussed it. I don't think we had it. We discussed it at considerable length, Mr. Chairman,
and agreed by the government.
And agreed, it says the rest of section 4 down there says an agreement with the governing body and representatives of the news media. It is assumed that the understanding will take place before the meeting begins.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend the amendment.
You want to back to that
again? How would you by adding, deleting the period after media and adding the following words: prior to such executive session. Reach their agreement. They're saying here by inserting shall in each place. If they shall agree.
I wouldn't have any objection to that.
Bob, how do you feel about that?
Well, I would prefer it otherwise. I would prefer it naked, but if I can't get it naked, I'll take it with this.
Okay, Representative Cole amends the amendment to include on line 28 after the period prior to such executive session.
Release period.
Sorry, after the meeting. Any more discussion? Representative Cole?
Aye.
Representative
Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Engel?
No.
Representative
Humphrey? Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to amend Section 8, lines 10 to 11, page 5, as follows.
We're going to vote on the
amendment.
Whoops.
Vote on the amendment.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Vote on the full amendment now.
Representative Cole?
Aye.
Representative
Drell? Aye.
Representative
Engel?
Aye.
Representative Humphrey?
Aye.
Representative
Humphrey? Aye. Mr. Chairman, I move to amend Section 8, lines 10 to 11, page 5, as follows. No decision shall be voided by the court because of a violation of this act unless such decision violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
Any discussion?
Can I have a copy of that?
There is a copy of April
15.
Now I've got it. Here we go.
Really? Where are they?
Amendments to SB 15, April 15. Section 8 there, line 10, 11, page 5.
Well, I'm a little curious myself now that I've read it.
As it reads now, line 10, it says, no decision shall be voided by the court because of a violation of this act. And just added on after that. Such decision violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
Mr. Chairman, this language comes from legislative counsel, and the question, the language addresses itself to the problem of what would be equitable relief under the Act in Section 8. You have an internal contradiction. Sometimes the only equitable relief that might be possible would be to overturn an act, so they're saying that something that involves a right, something that's not internal or administrative or procedural, not dealing with those things that are exempt. But if a city council were to go in and rezone some property in violation of the Act, and there was no possible way to overturn that rezoning, or if not that, I see the Attorney General waiving that. Some other question where there may be a problem of a violation of a right, the person would have a harder time getting relief.
What you said helps me understand that there is not a complete analysis of what this means. That's why I asked the question before. Now, for example, did the other law, not this act, create the right? Is it a violation of another law, not this act, that we're using to overturn the decision to invalidate it, or is it simply and only a violation of this act, not the other one, which we are allowing to be the basis for overturning the decision?
Would be the former, not the latter.
If that's the case, maybe we should say, unless such decision otherwise violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or. And I think that makes better sense. I would like a better two sentences, but as far as I'm concerned, that covers that puts the court in the right ballpark. Unless that decision otherwise violates the rights of the person vested or arising under any other law or. What we're really trying to do is say that the first part of Section 8 does not mean that the guy's got a right for some other reason, for some other law, he's out of court. That's what we're really trying to say. Mm-hmm. I think the word otherwise is difficult.
Right. Mr. Attorney General, did you have a comment on that you'd like to make?
I am quite confused by the language.
Yes, I have a federal officer. I may have to contend with it. I sure wish you wouldn't include it. Well, how about backing off and stopping the sentence the way it reads now? No decision shall be voided by the court because of the violation of this act, period. However, nothing contained in this section 8 shall deprive a person of a right vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
One thing I was thinking about, Ed, that bothered me is under any other law, what about contract?
Oh, boy.
I really would like to raise the question, why do you need the last sentence?
Good.
I think a court is going to be extremely leery about voiding any action. If it did avoid an action, I think it would probably be the court. It would be an extremist situation in which the court would not need to do other vested rights.
Are you suggesting a period after circumstances or after reports?
After reports. At least the last sentence. be within the equitable power of the court, presumably they could void an action in a strange situation. I really would have to be a very strange situation before any court that I know of would take that action.
I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman, wasn't the reason we put that last sentence in is because of the concern of there being continuing attempts to override previous actions of the council, city council or school board or whatever it might be, which might throw out a bond issue, for example.
The Attorney General has in mind a different one of the three objectives that I asked about.
Such decision otherwise violates the right of, you've got that otherwise in there before.
The way this reads is that the decision could be voided, and there are circumstances that I don't understand. I think that I agree on that.
We don't understand why, but.
Take care of it.
Okay. I'll buy it, Mr. Chairman. I withdraw my original motion and suggest change it because of tolling. With a period after act.
So that would be no decision shall be voided by the court solely because of violation of this act.
Right.
Representative Engel moves to amend line 11, page 5, striking, pardon me, adding the word solely after court. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Durelli?
Aye.
Representative
Engel?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
We have another amendment to
Mr. Park. Isn't that? Oh, I think.
Mr. Cohen, that should be a current resolution or something. I don't really think Vaughn can.
I haven't even read it.
Mr. Carson is suggesting someplace, somehow, we get in the word resolution or something. The legislature should conduct a continuing study of the open meetings law with particular emphasis on the exclusion and exemption provided in the law, and if considered advisable, make recommendations for additional legislation. I'm not sure what the proper form of something like that is if the committee believes that it's a good idea.
Well, as that judge in New York said, no one's property is safe when the legislature is in session, so every time we're in session, we could change it anyway, and that's all that says is that he expresses an intention to look at it, to kind of single it out to look at.
I'm kind of with you. Why waste $900 to get a bill printed up and talk to it anyway?
It doesn't add anything to the law.
No, I don't think we're on the law.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really confident from the group that I've got in with me and someone that's going to be a very studious discussion of this during the coming interim.
I was just since Mr. Carson is the advocate of this, that we perhaps would be well advised to wait until he is here to promote it. So we'll lay that. I hate to use the words on the table, but we'll postpone action on this until Mr. Carson is present. We'll just lay it aside, huh? Pardon? I'll entertain a motion to.
I move we rerun the bill and send it to the full act recommendation.
Representative Cole moves that we re-engross the bill and send it to the floor of the House for a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cole?
Aye.
Representative Rayleigh?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Representative Engel?
Aye.
Copy this other report on the last report of those bills we heard last week so that you can see all these when we get them up next time.
Did you do anything relative to the section or pornography?
Is that something like that?
I'm trying to get rid of that one. Mr. Hurd belongs in another committee that can bear some other bill on today. Pardon?
We have a bill.
Which one is it?
I think they have another bill. Okay, meeting adjourned.
What?
Oh, no.
Joint Special Committee on Professional Responsibilities, April 23rd, 1973.
Oh, we're looking here all of this stuff.